From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now! Saddam Hussein in the dock. We'll take a look at the pretrial hearing and how U.S. officials censored tapes of the hearings. We'll speak with Saddam Hussein's lawyer. And we'll talk with the mother of a U.S. soldier killed in Iraq just 2 weeks ago, as well as independent filmmaker Urban Hamid. He provided Michael Moore with some of his footage from Iraq for the film Fahrenheit 9/11. Today, we'll speak with Urban Hamid about the conversations he had with U.S. soldiers he was embedded with.
And they don't want to be there either.
Today, the reports are AP and CNN are saying John Edwards is John Kerry's pick for vice presidential running mate. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. CNN and the Associated Press are reporting Senator John Kerry will pick North Carolina Senator John Edwards today as his vice presidential running mate. Kerry and Edwards both ran against each other earlier this year for the party's nomination. Edwards, the first-time senator who worked as a trial lawyer before seeking office. Kerry is expected to make the official announcement in email to supporters and will appear at a rally in Pittsburgh. The New York Post reports in the paper today, full front page story, that Kerry has picked Congressmember Richard Gephardt, but the paper didn't cite how it obtained the information. In Iraq, the U.S. killed up to 12 people in Fallujah Monday when it dropped four 500-pound bombs and two 1,000-pound bombs against a target described by the U.S. as a Mujahideen safe house. It was the deadliest attack since the so-called handover of power last week. Iraq's elected Prime Minister Yadalawi said his government provided intelligence to the U.S. military for the attack. In other news from Iraq, three Marines died in the province of Al-Anbar. A total of 10 soldiers have died in the region over the past week. The U.S. military censored major portions of Saddam Hussein's hearing last week. The military ordered camera crews not to record the audio proceedings. They ordered stations not to broadcast images of Saddam Hussein being led into the courtroom in handcuffs. And the military edited out portions of the proceedings when it released the audio to news outlets. According to Robert Fisk of the London Independent, the U.S. cut out Saddam Hussein saying, quote, "This is theater. Bush is the real criminal." Unedited audio of most of the proceedings made it out only because news crews pretended not to be recording under U.S. orders. One U.S. television crew member said of the U.S. military officials, quote, "They were running the show. The Americans decided what the world could and could not see of this trial, and it was meant to be an Iraqi trial," the source said. A newly declassified Army study of the Iraq invasion confirms the U.S. military stage managed the fall of Saddam Hussein's statue in Baghdad. According to the Army's own report, a Marine colonel decided to topple the statue, and an Army psyops worked to make the toppling of the statue appear to be a spontaneous undertaking by Iraqi civilians. This according to the Los Angeles Times. The psyops team used loudspeakers to encourage Iraqis to gather in Firdo Square, and a Marine recovery vehicle was used to topple the statue with a chain. 5 million people became infected with AIDS last year, according to a new report issued today by the United Nations. It's the highest single-year count ever recorded. The UN's also reporting about 38 million worldwide were infected with HIV. 9 out of 10 people with the disease are in urgent need of treatment but are not getting it. UNAIDS chief Peter Piot told the Associated Press, quote, "The virus is running faster than all of us." In an initial draft of its 2004 platform, the Democratic Party has condemned the Bush administration's unilateral foreign policy approach, but has decided not to describe the war in Iraq as a mistake or to call for withdrawal of U.S. troops in Iraq. Half of the 60-page draft, which was released on Saturday, concerns national security. It charges the Bush administration has, quote, walked away from more than 100 years of American leadership in the world. In a shift from the party's 2000 platform, the Democrats have dropped a reference to endorsing the Kyoto Treaty on global warming. The platform also calls for the minimum wage to be raised from $5.15 an hour to $7 and for the rollback of tax cuts to the wealthiest 2%. In another shift from the Clinton-Gore years, the platform does not endorse the use of the death penalty. On Israel, the platform explicitly endorses for the first time an independent Palestinian state, but it also supports Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's controversial so-called security measures. Meanwhile, the Boston Globe's reporting Senator John Kerry has released a new policy paper on Israel in which he fully supports Israel's construction of the 425-mile wall through the West Bank. Last year, Kerry said the wall was a, quote, barrier to peace, but in the new policy paper, Kerry writes, quote, the security fence is a legitimate act of self-defense. The title of the paper is Strengthening Israel's Security and Bolstering the U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. In one part of the paper, Kerry concludes, quote, Israel's cause must be America's cause. Attempts by the Democratic Party to keep Ralph Nader off the ballot in Arizona have succeeded. On Friday, the independent presidential candidate conceded he would not qualify for the Arizona ballot. The Democrats had sued an attempt to invalidate Nader's ballot petition. In other campaign news, the Forward newspaper is reporting President Bush's campaign has refused to withdraw an ad featuring Adolf Hitler. The ad juxtaposes pictures and audio of Hitler with images of John Kerry, Vice President Al Gore, Congressmember Richard Gephardt, and Howard Dean. In other news, Palestinian politician Azmi Bashara, who serves in the Israeli Knesset, has entered the third day of a hunger strike to protest the West Bank wall. Bashara said, quote, I'm doing this to tell the world about the serious damage and dreadful suffering the wall is causing for hundreds of thousands of people. Meanwhile, in Nablus, four Palestinians and a 25-year-old Israeli army officer have died after Israeli Marine commandos raided a nearby refugee camp. Among the dead are a Palestinian engineering professor, Dr. Khaled Salah, and his 15-year-old son, Mohammed. Also killed were two senior leaders of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. At the annual meeting of CARICOM in Grenada, five Caribbean countries have called on the Caribbean community to officially recognize the new U.S.-backed Haitian government, which took over after President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was overthrown in a coup he said was orchestrated by the United States. Jamaican Prime Minister P.J. Patterson has opposed allowing Haiti to retake its seat in the 15-nation CARICOM. Last month, the Caribbean leaders voted to have the Organization of American States investigate the circumstances of Aristide's ouster. Lawyers from Legal Aid in New York have filed a lawsuit against prison officials at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn after the lawyers learned the prison secretly videotaped at least 40 meetings between the lawyers and their clients. The detention center was largely used to hold Arab and Muslim immigrants detained after the September 11th attacks. The New York Times is reporting the U.S. orchestrated a secret prison swap last year involving five Saudis held at Guantanamo Bay. The deal saw Saudi Arabia release six British citizens who had confessed under torture to carrying out bombings in Saudi Arabia. In return, the U.S. released five Saudi detainees. The deal was initiated by Robert Jordan, the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia, in an attempt to satisfy calls from two of Washington's strongest supporters of the Iraq invasion. In Kentucky, the Lexington Herald Leader newspaper issued a front-page apology on Sunday for failing to adequately cover the civil rights movement four decades ago. The correction appeared 2 days after the 40th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. The paper wrote in part, quote, "It has come to the editor's attention that the Herald Leader neglected to cover the civil rights movement. We regret the omission," unquote. The editor's note accompanied a series of articles titled Front Page News, Back Page Coverage. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Pakistani immigrant Faisal Olvi has won the battle to stay in this country. Olvi traveled to the United States 8 years ago, applied for political asylum. After he missed an asylum hearing, he was issued deportation orders. He came so close to being deported, he was on the airport tarmac when INS authorities received a cell phone call from a federal judge ordering that Faisal Olvi be pulled off the plane. Faisal Olvi remained in the country. He has been married to a U.S. citizen for years, Nadine Young. He helped raise Nadine's two children. 3 years ago, they had a child of their own, Shaheen. We broadcast the story on Thursday just before he went to court in New York about whether or not he would be able to remain in this country. Right after Election Day 2002, Faisal Olvi was picked up by immigration authorities, taken from his home as they broke into it. 2 months later, the Olvi family won a major victory. A federal immigration judge, Patricia Rohan, gave Faisal permission to file a marriage petition with immigration authorities. After a 2-year battle, the judge on Thursday, after Faisal Olvi and Nadine Young left our studios, went to court, and she ruled that the judge ruled that she would not only she would not grant Faisal Olvi a temporary green card, but a permanent one. We have been getting email throughout the weekend asking what actually happened. Faisal Olvi joins us on the line. Welcome to Democracy Now! And congratulations, Faisal.
Good morning, Amy. How are you doing?
Can you tell us what happened?
You, Mr. Gonzalez, your radio station, and all the viewers and everybody and whoever supported me while I was inside the prison and while I was outside.
Can you tell us what happened on Thursday afternoon when you went to court?
As you all know, we were speaking together on the issue of Mr. Musharraf, also the guy who was in the prison for taking pictures. And after you interviewed me, my wife, and my lawyer, Liz, my hearing was supposed to be at 3 in the afternoon. Just suddenly that day, my lawyer got a call from my judge that they are trying to do it half an hour earlier, around 2:30. And I just jumped, and I had a, I had started having wives like, why are they going to, have an extra half an hour? So I thought the proceedings are going to take longer than, as usual, because half an hour, they might have something else. Well, thanks God, we went over there, the hearing started. As I said, Judge Patricia Rowan was very nice to me, and just because of her, I'm just over here today. And the district attorney came around 2:30, and the case started beginning. There's a lot of other supporters over there, since you already have said to the TV that if they want to have, it's an open hearing. And the case just started, and the district attorney just started asking a couple of questions about my case and everything, about my wife, and, what I do and how's everything. And then the judge approached my lawyer that if she needs to ask me something, but there's nothing to ask because the case is in media and everywhere for since two and a half years now almost. But finally, she ruled it up that, she is going to grant me permanent residency, not even temporary, since my marriage is legal to Nadine is from 2001. And just then right there, everybody's in the bag. Even the people who I don't even know started crying out of joy. Even my lawyer and It was just so emotional that I can't even mention it. But, you know, that when you struggle so much and you just get something right away like that after so long. So it was a good and a bad feeling that I suffered, but it was a good that, you know, thanks God, after all, everything is finished, you know. And thanks much thanks to the district attorney office also, because they understood the case. You know, if they wanted to, they can, you could, you know how they are, they can do anything, you know, to just not to give it to me. But, you know, I really thanks the district attorney office also as much as I thanks to Ms. Rohan and every one of you, most important, you know. Without your support, it was not going to be possible.
Well, Faisal Olvi, I want to thank you very much for being with us, for bringing us the good news. Again, a lot of listeners and viewers around the country over the weekend questioning us, asking what exactly happened. Faisal Olvi has been granted a permanent green card by federal judge Patricia Rohan this past week, had been detained by immigration authorities. You can go to our website and see our 2 years of coverage on this case at democracynow.org. Thanks for being with us this morning. Senator John Kerry has selected Senator John Edwards of North Carolina to be his vice presidential running mate. According to all the reports earlier today, Kerry informed Edwards of the decision in a brief telephone call. Kerry is expected to make the public announcement at a rally in downtown Pittsburgh later this morning. The two will campaign together later today and this week. We are joined on the line right now by John Nichols. He writes for The Nation magazine, as well as one of the editors of the Madison Capital Times. Welcome to Democracy Now!, John.
It's great to be with you, Amy, and it's great to be on following that success story.
Well, today, the New York Post did a full front page story that said, Kerry picks Gephardt. All the other reports, we broadcast 8 to 9 Eastern Standard Time, so it's before the official announcement. But all the reports, AP, Washington Post, CNN, are saying that, in fact, John Kerry has chosen John Edwards, fellow senator, for this position to be his vice presidential running mate. Can you comment on and give us a background of John Edwards?
Well, first off, I'll tell you that unless John Edwards stumbles badly between now and 9 a.m. at Pittsburgh time, he will be the choice. They've very quietly flown him into Pittsburgh, so he's there. And the other potential contenders are not. A lot of people got this wrong, largely because John Kerry played it very close to the vest. He has proven that he's probably better than the Bush folks at keeping a secret, which is maybe counts for something. I don't know. Most of us journalists should probably be mad about that. But the choice of John Edwards is a very cautious choice for Kerry. He doesn't like Edwards that much. That's been pretty well established. It wasn't that he hated him. They didn't have a good chemistry. He particularly saw Edwards as sort of an interloper, somebody who jumped in very late in the game, both to politics in general and to the presidential race in particular. But Edwards' strong showing in the later primaries made him someone that everyone saw as the logical, quote-unquote, pick. And because Kerry didn't get far enough ahead in the polls, in fact, really is basically tied in most polls at this point, he was forced to skip over choices he might have liked more and to go for the person that insiders in the party see as bringing the most to the ticket. And that's why you end up with John Edwards.
Let's talk about his record, John Edwards' record. You have a piece, Angry About the War Candidate, not to be confused with the anti-war candidate.
That's exactly right. I mean, one thing to understand about John Edwards is that most of what progressives would object to John Kerry about, they would also object to John Edwards about. John Edwards voted in favor of the October 2002 resolution authorizing the president to go to war in Iraq. He also voted in favor of the Patriot Act. He has a decent record on trade, much better than Kerry's, but not a great record on those issues. He's got a good record on labor issues, probably a little better than Kerry's. On environment, he's a little weaker than Kerry. On rural and farm issues, he's a little weaker than Kerry. So he's a mix, but he's certainly not a more progressive contender. The one thing that made him stand out in the primaries was that he was able to present an angry or a passionate stance about a lot of these issues that appealed to Democrats who thought Kerry was too weak. For instance, on the war, he was and is a supporter of the invasion and occupation, and yet he delivered a lot of speeches in Iowa and New Hampshire and other places in which he passionately denounced war profiteering. And that may be his strongest suit. It's not just war profiteering that he was a very big critic of. He is more willing to criticize corporations than Kerry has been. In addition, he is much blunter and actually quite good on talking about the need to close the yawning gap between rich and poor in this country and to try and do more for poor Americans. So I think he appealed to a lot of liberal and progressive Democrats who weren't necessarily, who knew his flaws, but liked his rhetoric. And I think you'll see him playing somewhat of a similar role as he joins the Kerry ticket.
Let's talk about John Edwards as trial lawyer, which people like Newt Gingrich have made a very dirty word, trial lawyer. But can you talk about exactly what his record was, who he represented?
Sure. He was a very good trial lawyer, in fact, one of the best in the country. Remember, he grew up in, he wasn't as poor as he likes to tell folks, but he did grow up relatively working class, lower middle class, went to law school, came out, and quickly became a trial lawyer. And he became very, very rich doing that. And the reason is he was good at it. And he took on a lot of really tough cases involving children who were harmed by different drugs and different surgical procedures. He represented a lot of, you know, working-class folks who were harmed in industrial accidents and different incidents involving their work. And he usually won. He likes to say that he saw his trial work as taking on big corporations in a way that the government usually doesn't. And there's some evidence to say that that is true. The interesting thing about John Edwards as regards his trial lawyer background is that, yes, over the last 15 or 20 years, the Republican right and really a lot of Democrats, even people, you know, in the Democratic Leadership Coalition, have tried to make trial lawyer a dirty word, have tried to support tort reform, et cetera, et cetera. Edwards, when he first ran for the Senate in 98, turned that around, and in his campaign, where he beat a Republican incumbent, he made the fact that he was a trial lawyer his best selling point. It was the evidence that he really was in touch with working folks who weren't represented otherwise. And that's the one thing that I think is really fascinating about Edwards. He is able to write his own storyline, not to allow himself to be defined into a corner by other folks. And he did that best with the trial lawyer stuff.
NAFTA.
He says he's against it.
He wasn't in the Senate to actually vote on it at the time.
98.
And John Kerry, a big corporate free trader.
John Kerry's got an unbelievably awful record on trade. John Edwards says he would have voted against NAFTA. As a member of the Senate, he has a mixed record on trade. He voted for some trade deals against others, but it is definitely a better record than Kerry's. What's fascinating is that in the primaries, again, Edwards sort of, as I said before, he writes his own story, even when it goes against his own record sometimes. In the primaries, he seized on trade as an issue, especially in Wisconsin and some of the later ones, and did very, very well with that issue. And the interesting thing is that he already has had a huge influence on Kerry, because Edwards talked about trade so much that he forced Kerry to say some specific things about what he would do, i.e., revisit old agreements and look to put labor and environmental standards into new agreements. I still have a lot of dubiousness about Kerry on the issue, but I will tell you that Edwards, I was with him a lot, I interviewed him a lot, and I think he actually came to recognize the danger of corporate free trade, largely from his own experience in North Carolina and South Carolina, where he was born, because he's seen those textile towns just dry up as a result of bad trade policies.
John Nichols, I want to ask you about the effect on Ralph Nader's campaign. In fact, Nader, I believe, recommended that John Kerry choose John Edwards. John Edwards' critique of corporations and courts holding them accountable, similar to that of Ralph Nader.
Yeah, Ralph Nader went out of his way to say that John Kerry should be the party's pick. That John Edwards, I apologize, should be the party's pick. And he has always, and every time I've talked to Ralph about these things, he's always had good words about Edwards. It isn't that he loves him. It isn't that he thinks he's perfect. But Ralph Nader likes trial lawyers, of course. And the other thing is that he really did have a great deal of respect for Edwards' rhetoric on these issues. And finally, and this is an important subtlety, in the Senate, Edwards was willing to stand up on a number of anti-corporate issues more so than most Democrats. It's the reason that not just Ralph Nader had some kind words for him, but also people like Ted Kennedy. And remember, internally within the Kerry campaign, Ted Kennedy was really advocating for Edwards because he saw Edwards as kind of a gutsy guy who was willing to take on some bigger issues and to do some rough stuff with it. And I think that's where the appeal is to a lot of kind of older Democrats and even non-Democrats who see Edwards as a relatively young guy with a little bit of spark.
John Nichols, I want to thank you for being with us. John
it's
Nichols of the Madison Capital Times in Wisconsin, a swing state. We are broadcasting 8 to 9 Eastern Standard Time. It's before the Pittsburgh rally, before the big announcement, but the Washington Post, CNN, AP are all announcing that John Edwards has been chosen, as John Nichols said, flown in secretly to Pittsburgh. The New York Post full-page story today on how Dick Gephardt was chosen as the vice presidential running mate of John Kerry. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Saddam Hussein appeared before an Iraqi judge last Thursday to face charges that may lead to a formal indictment for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. He wasn't represented by a lawyer, refused to sign a statement acknowledging he'd been charged and read his rights, including a right to legal counsel. Chief U.S. Administrator Paul Bremer, who stepped down last week, established the tribunal by decree on December 10th to try Saddam Hussein and 11 other top Ba'athist officials. It's headed by Salem Chalabi, the nephew of the disgraced Iraqi politician Ahmed Chalabi. Although legal custody of Saddam Hussein was reportedly transferred to Iraqi authorities, it's unclear what actual power the interim government has to over the former president. Robert Fisk of the London Independent writes, quote, "Americans continue to hold Saddam and Americans ran the court in which Saddam appeared. American soldiers in plain clothes were the civilians in the court. American officials censored the tapes of the hearing, lied about the judge's wish to record the sound of the trial, and marked the videotapes cleared by U.S. military. Three U.S. officers later confiscated all the original tapes of the trial," he said. Many lawyers say the trial is a political vendetta by Saddam's political foes and say only an international court would guarantee an impartial and fair hearing. We're joined on the phone right now by Curtis Dubler, who is the attorney, part of the Saddam Hussein legal team. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you explain what happened in court and why you or others who are representing Saddam Hussein, the attorneys, weren't there?
Yeah, I think it's first important to understand that what happened last week was really a charade. It had no or very little legal meaning, because it was not a transfer that would be valid under international law, under domestic law. The United States, as you pointed out, maintains control of the prisoner in this case, so they are responsible for his treatment. He was not even arraigned in court. The charges which were read out, if they were the charges, they would be a failing of the prosecutor because they would be easy to refute. They were so vague that they would not stand up in any court of law in any country of the world as valid charges. So really what took place last week was really a media charade by the United States in part and by the Iraqi interim authority to try to show that they are exercising some authority over this individual, and that's not the reality. And I believe from the United States' point of view, it was an attempt to try to get rid of their responsibility. It's interesting to note that a few hours before that took place, on the 29th of July, we actually filed, or Saddam Hussein filed, a petition of habeas corpus before, or an application for habeas corpus before the United States Supreme Court. Ordinarily, that means you could not transfer a prisoner if they were in the custody of a state or in the custody of the United States until that was dealt with. So I think that also just emphasizes the point that this trial is well outside the law. And unfortunately, the United States government does not intend to apply the basic guarantees of due process to this prisoner.
We're talking to one of the attorneys for Saddam Hussein. How did you get chosen, by the way? How does that work?
Well, I'm not at liberty to go into details of it, but the family, there were more than 1,500 lawyers put forward to the family, and the family decided that some of them were lawyers that they wanted to represent them. I was asked by an intermediary, not the family directly, and I think most of the lawyers were chosen for different areas of expertise, and I would imagine there probably were not a lot of international human rights lawyers, which is my area of expertise, that were interested in this matter.
And can you explain what happened? We had reports, CNN, the New York Times, about a scared Saddam Hussein in the courtroom. And then the sound leaked out. How did this take place? Explain exactly why we weren't supposed to see this, who was deciding this, and what happened.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you more about that. I really am, ourselves, we're not so much in the know about what is happening in this matter. As you know, we have not been allowed to meet our client yet, which is in itself a gross violation of his human rights. I think it was quite unfortunate that the incoming High Commissioner for Human Rights in the United Nations, Louis Arbour, has indicated that we have to wait to determine whether or not there's been a violation of human rights in this case. But there already are very clear violations of human rights, including the most basic of the rights to fair trial, the right to an independent and impartial tribunal. And until we are able to have regular contact with our client, as any lawyer would in any type of a criminal matter, whether it be a mass murderer or a petty criminal, we are not able really to tell you more than what you see through the eyes of the American military.
We're also joined on the line by Sam Husseini, Washington-based political analyst. Your comments on what we saw and didn't see and hear Thursday in the courtroom in Iraq.
I thought it was fascinating how the issues that Saddam raised. He wasn't a particularly good propagandist when he was in office, I thought. But I thought a lot of what he said was very effective. When he was asked about the invasion of Kuwait, his response was, how could Saddam be tried over Kuwait, which said it would reduce Iraqi women to 10 dinar prostitutes? He's simultaneously talking about issues of economic disparity and economic justice in the Arab world, exploitation of Iraqi women, national dignity, and so on. This is very potent stuff, and what I'm concerned is what's going to play out here is that a lot of very legitimate issues. He called Bush a criminal. Somebody was able on all of the TV networks to very calmly, not, you know, shouting in the street as, you know, a lot of peace protesters are reduced to, very calmly say, Bush is a criminal. Bush the criminal. And juxtapose that with one of the segments that you said, noted earlier, Amy, the Democratic platform will not even call the Iraq invasion a mistake at this point. I mean, usually a mistake is a watered-down version of a watered-down version of saying something is, you know, aggression or criminal, so on and so forth. So now we're in this situation where virtually the only person granted a substantial platform to denounce U.S. policy in very crisp, clear terms as criminal, as aggression, as murderous, is himself a murderous criminal. And this is incredibly unhealthy. Incredibly unhealthy that no one with clean hands, by and large, I mean, there are rare exceptions, of somebody allowed to have a national or international platform and get beyond the mealy-mouthed, this is unfortunate unilateral action. This is unwise diplomacy when the U.S. is, you know, bombing the hell out of Fallujah with when the U.S. government is engaged in clear and obvious aggression, and this is going to play I fear that this is going to play, and I think that it would be important for people, Arab Americans, and anybody who sees through and is critical of the duplicities of U.S. policy, to not hitch anything to this. It's going to be very tempting, I think, with people, and I've heard it on talk shows already, of people to say, and indeed, Saddam Hussein's procedural rights, and I wouldn't doubt for a minute other rights are being violated in this, and that should be objected to on a principle level. But it's exceedingly unfortunate, and we have to think about where we are as people of conscience, presumably, that we're in a situation where the person who gets to say it, to call it like it is, vis-a-vis U.S. policy, is himself devoid of standing in the issue.
Final comment from Curtis Dibbler. The latest report we have now out of Amman from Reuters is that the Jordan-based defense team for Saddam Hussein is headed to Iraq, a convoy of buses being arranged to transport hundreds of legal experts to Baghdad. Sam Hazawi, a prominent lawyer on one of the 21-strong defense team hired by Saddam's wife, told Reuters the among the large contingent of lawyers ready to defend Saddam are 700 non-Arabs, including 400 Americans and Europeans. 200 legal consultants from across the world have also pledged to help in the case, he said. More than half of the over 2,000 lawyers volunteering to defend President Saddam are expected to join the trip. Are you going? Mr. Dibbler.
From the wife of Saddam Hussein, and there are many that are interested in assisting, and I think right now we're trying to move very cautiously. As you can imagine, in a matter like this, there are many people that come out of the woodwork and are interested in being involved, and I think it's up to the family, really, to determine who at this point, and then later the prisoner himself, to determine who should be involved. I'd like to very quickly just comment on what the last speaker said. Although some of this calling Bush a war criminal and pointing out that the aggression against Iraq was patently illegal under international law might be new to America, I work in more than 50 countries abroad, and in every other country in the world, that was clear from the start, and there were people publicly, even sometimes the leaders of those countries, saying that this war was illegal. So I think perhaps the impact of Saddam Hussein's statements will be a surprise to the Americans, but to the rest of the world, they're exactly what they've been hearing, and they sound, unfortunately, perhaps, but also, I think, in a very realistic way, as a very realistic appraisal of the situation that took place in Iraq.
Finally, the legal defense team for the deposed Iraqi president Saddam Hussein has chosen an Iraqi lawyer to represent him in court. This just out, Saddam's Jordan-based lawyers say the special tribunal conducting the trial has insisted the defense counsel be an Iraqi. The name of the Iraqi lawyer has not been revealed out of fear of his own security and reprisals, said Mr. Assam Ghazawi, the Jordanian lawyer, in court last week, the preliminary charges read to Saddam Hussein. I want to thank you both for being with us. We've been speaking with Curtis Doebler, who is one of the team of lawyers defending Saddam Hussein, and also speaking with Sam Husseini, a Washington-based political analyst. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we will speak with the mother of a young soldier who has died in Iraq, and then we'll speak with a former embedded photographer who provided some of the film to Michael Moore for Fahrenheit 9/11, talking about his conversations with U.S. soldiers in Iraq. Stay with us.
I'm your masters of war. Here that build the big guns. Here that build the death planes. Here that build all the bombs. Here that hide behind walls. Here that hide behind disks. I just don't want you to know I can see through your masks. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. And you turn and run farther when the fast bullets fly. Like Judas of old, you lie and deceive. A world war can be won. You want me to believe, but I see through your eyes, and I see through your brain. Like I see through the water that runs down my drain.
Masters of War, Bob Dylan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, the largest public media collaboration in this country. I'm Amy Goodman. As we broadcast this program from 8 to 9 Eastern Standard Time in the morning, John Kerry's email has gone out as promised to his to people around the country. As he tries to build his email list, he said he would send out his pick for vice presidential candidate before it was publicly announced. Tens of thousands of people joined the list to get that early announcement, and he has made the announcement saying that he has chosen Senator John Edwards and is having the rally in Pittsburgh. Well, we turn now to a grieving mother. 2 weeks ago today, Army National Guard Special Patrick McCaffrey was shot dead in an ambush in Iraq. He was 34 years old, the father of two. His son is 9 years old, his daughter 2 years old. Patrick McCaffrey had joined the National Guard on the day after the September 11th attacks with hopes of helping the country recover. He never expected to serve in combat, but in March, his National Guard unit was deployed to Iraq. On June 22nd, he was shot dead alongside National Guard Lieutenant Andre Tyson of Riverside, California. His death received national attention last week when his mother, Nadja McCaffrey, invited the press to Sacramento International Airport to record images of his flag-draped coffin returning home. Since his body was flown in on a commercial flight, the Pentagon's ban on photos of coffins did not apply. We're joined now by Patrick's mother, Nadja McCaffrey, who is speaking to us from California. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
And our deepest sympathies to you on the loss of your son.
Thank you. Thank you, Amy.
you have just buried your son. Can you talk about him? Can you talk about Patrick?
With pleasure. As you say, Patrick was 34 years old. He was a gentleman, and he was someone with a big, big heart. He has helped not hundreds of people, as I first thought, but thousands. And the reaction, the email, the phone calls, has been totally overwhelming. And when I say thousands, I'm talking about Iraq, Europe, and the United States. People have listened to Patrick's life, try to understand why he died and what his life was about. Why did I call the media? I didn't really call the media, but I did agree for the media to be in Sacramento when my son's body arrived. Yes. The reason, the main reason for that at the time was I needed people to know what is going on today. Not just here, but in Iraq also. To my eyes, this gesture was for my grandchildren and for my ex-husband or my husband and I later in life. My granddaughter is 2 years old. She will not remember her dad. My grandson is 9, and he will forget. They both remember right now the day he stepped on the plane on his way to Iraq. Everybody remembered that day very clearly. But I wanted this to be his day of coming home, the flag on a coffin. The arrival in Sacramento was the way he came home. And I want my grandchildren to remember that. More than that, I want all the mothers that are going through the same thing as I am going today to pay attention. We cannot ignore anymore what is going on in Iraq and here. And I am not taking a political stand on this. I am speaking as a mother and as a human being. Patrick was a very gentle soul. And when I say he helps thousands, I will give you some examples. The stories are flowing now, from Iraq mainly, but also from his high school friend who were at his ceremony when we buried him on Thursday and Friday. For example, when Patrick died, he was wearing the radio for his unit. The radio that he had on his back weighed 75 pounds. Their gear alone weighed 75 pounds. Nobody could carry this radio on the long term. Patrick was a bodybuilder. So what happened was the soldier would collapse under there. It was too heavy. The heat is 125 degrees. So Patrick just said, forget it, I will do it. Don't worry, guys, I'll do it for you. And he apparently did it. The heat exhaustion is atrocious. The fatigue that the soldiers are going through right now is not human. I call this unhuman. Every time, lately when Patrick would call, he would call every 2 days because he was worried about us, worrying about him. He would say, Mom, I'm so tired. I'm so exhausted. We haven't slept for so long. And this would go on and on and on, time after time. He was very disillusioned with his mission in Iraq. What happened was he signed up, like you said, after 9/11. To make a difference. He didn't need to do this. He had a very good job for a long time. He was making very excellent money. And his life was fine, was perfect. His reaction was to what happened to this country. He felt helpless. He wanted to help out. And in his mind and heart, well, the National Guard were here to help out within the country. In case of any catastrophe. It could be natural catastrophe or something like 9/11. He didn't think at all about the possibility of being deployed. When the time came and people started to talk about possibility of the Guard being deployed, and then the fact came, he for sure knew that he was going to go. He just sat with me a few times, and we talked about it. But his final logical answer to this was, Mom, I signed up. I took my responsibility the day I signed up, and I must stand up to what I did. So he did. And Patrick was a very cheerful, very positive person. Once in Iraq, he was looking forward to try to make a difference there with people, with the way we help them, supposedly. And he was, you know, anxious to become part of this whole Iraqi freedom thing. Well, that didn't last very long. Just after his first mission, he called me and his wife. He usually is very cheerful, like, hi, Mom, how are you? You know, how are the children, so on. This time, no, it wasn't like that. It was, hi, Mom, waited a minute. I said, what's wrong? And then he said, I don't understand why we're here. They hate us. They just hate us. And Patrick was very hurt by that, very deeply hurt by that. He realized that, you know, there was nothing to be done about the fact that they hate Americans, but also European. They just don't want anybody there. They just want to be in their country on their own terms and so on. Well, when Patrick definitely realized that, he turned to the children, the Iraqi children, and he was asking us to send constantly boxes and boxes of goodies. I mean, like cookies, for example, candy, some nutritional things like Gatorade, powder Gatorade, also toys. One of the last emails I got from him is asking for a box of deflated soccer ball with a pump in it, so we could give that to the kids. He also was giving water and some of his food, because there is no running water, no electricity. Those people have nothing. And he was enjoying doing this. He was really full of happiness. There is a picture that I sent you, who is Patrick sitting on top of a Humvee holding some white flowers. This picture was taken not even an hour before his death. And those flowers were given to him by the children. When they saw Patrick and some of the people of his unit, they would recognize the Humvee and they would run to them, waiting, you know, for the things that they were going to get. And this just happened. When the picture is taken, Patrick is just glowing with joy, with inner joy. And that should speak, you know, for itself. There is another one where he is giving an IV to a soldier who had collapsed from heat exhaustion. Patrick was also a combat lifesaver, and he took that very, very seriously. He was constantly looking after the soldier. And even at camp, he was well known to walk around camp, and Camp Anaconda is huge. So thousands of people know him. He was wearing a chain with pictures of his family on a chain, showing it to everybody. And when you would see a soldier sitting down somewhere, depressed, or even crying, Patrick would sit next to him, hug him, and cheer the guy up. He was well known for doing that.
Nadja McCaffrey is talking about her son, Patrick McCaffrey, who died in Iraq, brought back to California, and She and her husband called the press to take pictures of his flag-draped coffin, yes, defying President Bush's executive order that photographs should not be taken of the coffins. We're also joined in the studio by Urban Hamid. Yeah, he is an independent filmmaker, photographer, was embedded and unembedded, a reporter, a photographer who is Swedish-Iraqi, and he joins us in our studio in New York. He provided some of the footage to Michael Moore for Fahrenheit 9/11 of the abuse of Iraqi prisoners and the raids, the U.S. soldiers touching the genitals of an Iraqi prisoner, posing for pictures. But in your time of being embedded, as you listened to Nadja McCaffrey, what did the soldiers, the U.S. soldiers, say to you? Who were you embedded with, Urban?
I was embedded with Charlie Company, and we were outside Beled, which is very close to Samara. And they would, you know, come up to me and basically express, you know, similar thoughts as Patrick did to his mother, how they didn't know why they were there. They wanted to go home. They missed their family. Their conditions are extremely tough that they're living under. And so much of what Nadja is telling about her son sort of resonates with what I heard and saw.
You describe and you filmed a detention facility right on top of the roof of where the soldiers stayed. Can you describe that?
It was basically just a maybe 15, 16 square feet area that was fenced off by this razor wire, and you know, there was no protection against the sun, no protection against the rain, and the soldiers said that they would keep the detainees up there, and nobody would, you know, last that long without within a few days they would start talking. They that was a way of softening them up.
As an Iraqi yourself, how did these U.S. soldiers respond to you being embedded with them?
They knew me only as a Swedish journalist, but you know, this is not a matter of being Iraqi or Swedish. I think it's a matter of being a human being. You know, we all know what is, you know, right and what's wrong, and this was definitely not right.
You say that soldiers expressed concern. What were they saying?
I remember one of the last conversations I had was in January, and a sergeant was basically telling his fellow soldiers that, you know, I understand why the Iraqis hate us. He said that, you know, we have all been duped and we know that, and we should not be here in the first place. And the interesting thing was that he was talking about four or five other soldiers, and they did not disagree. They were all listening to him. And I think that he, to me, represents sort of the kind of concerns and objections that many, many soldiers in Iraq have, many American soldiers have.
I want to thank you, Urban Hamid, for joining us once again, and I hope to continue this conversation with you before you return to Iraq. And Nadja McCaffrey, again, our condolences on the death of your son, Patrick McCaffrey. And people can see pictures who are listening, not watching Democracy Now! Right now, online at democracynow.org, pictures of Patrick McCaffrey fallen in Iraq. That does it for today's program. This week, as we continue our exception to the Ruler's Tour, I'll be at Exit Art in New York City on July 7th. The next day, on Thursday, at the UNCA Club, the UN Correspondents Club at the United Nations. And on Friday, we'll broadcast from the swing state of Florida, from Tampa, at the Alliance for Community Media. You can go to our website to get more information, democracynow.org. Again, yes, John Kerry has announced his running mate. It's John Edwards. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hopto Caduce, Anna Noguera, Jeremy Scahill, Rich Kim, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.